Tonight we are considering four centuries of French ballet music and the composers who wrote for Paris's dancers. To guide us through what is a fascinating story, I'm joined by Jane Pritchard, who is curator of dance at the Victoria and Albert Museum, and Richard Langham-Smith, research professor here at the Royal College of Music, a man whose interests stretch from the French Baroque to the music of Debussy. Very useful for this evening. Please welcome my guests. Well, given that the repertoire in tonight's concert, Lully and Rameau, then Delibes and Massenet, and finally Stravinsky, is spread into three sections of time, it makes some sense for us to divide our conversation into three parts as well. Let's start with the Baroque. Jane, the first surviving score of a French ballet comes from 1581, so even that early, Paris was ballet capital of the world.
I think one can say that the interest in dance as a real focus had shifted by that time from Italy to France. And yes, from then on, I think one has always actually got to consider what is happening, particularly in Paris, but in France generally.
Richard, was there ever a monarch who loved his ballet as much as Louis XIV did?
Yes, probably Louis XIII. I think the whole thing of the king dancing the grand ballet at the end of the year, maybe one a year, became a sort of institution. Because ballet, all you had to know if you wanted to get on in court was how to dance.
Why? Why was it so important?
Well, I think it's something to do with the idea that if you learn the discipline of dancing, you somehow learn control and order and rhythm and all those things the French loved so much, whereas in Italy, singing seems to have been more important.
What did the dancers look like? What did the dancers wear in Lully's time?
Well, the dancers are wearing costumes that look very, very heavy. I mean, we think of dancers loving to wear next to nothing because then they can move freely. But basically, it's the same as court costume, elaborated, because we're looking at costumes that essentially are masks. Often, the dancers did actually have masks on as well, and elaborate headdresses, which, of course, modern dancers loathe. But they were, you know, as I say, really parading, moving, rather than sort of leaping around or anything like that. Of course, shoes would have had heels. Coats would be heavy. At this time, it was all men. It wasn't women being part of it. Very few women seem to have sort of crept in, but it was really a very masculine art form at this point.
It's very interesting you mention about trying to recapture performances, because although we can never quite know, we spend an awful lot of time doing it. And one of the things about Lully, which is the most important thing that happened for string playing, was that a German, Georg Muffat, went and listened to Lully's band playing as they did with their bows actually going the same way, and notated absolutely everything they did, how they used bowings in minuets, short bows and slightly shorter ones, huge detail. If we didn't know that, the past 50 years of trying to create a concert like tonight's just wouldn't exist.
Lully was absolutely in charge of music at court at this point, mm-hmm. wasn't he? I mean, he had the say on any other composers being used.
Absolutely. And, I mean, we all, even tonight, have an authentic conductor who is beating on the ground with a stick, not quite as hard as Lully did when he rammed it on his foot and caught gangrene. But the whole idea of the conductor is somewhere up for grabs tonight.
Lully had this great relationship with Molière that led to the music that we're hearing this evening. And this was almost the beginning, was it, of this sort of French idea of any stage art form had to have a bit of ballet in it.
Well, it's certainly the sort of the beginning whereby sort of dance gets integrated into the whole area of theatre. And so we think perhaps of sort of Bourgeois Gentilhomme as a play now, but when it was being performed, it was very deliberately worked so that you had opportunities for dance, not only that came directly out of the narrative, such as learning to dance, but also when the tailors come on to dress the gentleman, Monsieur Jourdain, they are actually dancing a minuet. So you integrated dance into the whole thing as to make it much more complete. And throughout sort of the French history, dance is often integrated into other areas of performance rather than kept in isolation.
And we'll talk about that with relation to the 19th century in a moment. Let's skip forward 65 years to 1735. Rameau's Zan Galant, first seen in 1735. France, too, perhaps had it become a bit less insular? Was there more of an interest in what was happening in Italy at this point?
I think there's always a sort of sense of what's going on, but I think France was very much also concerned with its own status, and I think that comes through very strongly in Les Zan Galant.
Well, certainly in music, the interest in Italy caused a great rumpus in France because there were the conservatives who wanted the music to stay like the air de cour and like Lully's music and not be invaded by these wild Italian violinists who played much too fast. And they also played with the regularity of a well-adjusted clock, where the French loved to make things swing a bit in this style called inégal, which is a bit like do-do-do-do-do, do-do-do. It's a bit more like jazz playing, which is not notated equally, but which just swings a little bit. And Rameau was one of those who really did things between the two. He made a music which had completely retained many of the French aspects, particularly of the dance rhythms behind it, but his violins move in a much, much more virtuosic way, his harmonies. He was a complete harmonic genius in a way and theorized it all, and his music is much more advanced. And he's beginning also to anticipate the modern orchestra, not using the oboes and the flutes just as instruments which play along with the violins, but which really have something idiomatic. You'll hear his music is very characterful, much more than Lully.
I think that virtuosity is something as well that's coming through in the dance as well. The dancers are performing far more in the way of sort of turns, so pirouettes, particularly still beaten steps, so cabrioles, entrechats, being very, very important. So the virtuosity of the dancers, certainly the leading dancers, is something that stands out. And so that's complemented by the music.
And there are clear narrative stories now.
Well, we're very much moving into, with something like sort of Zan Galant, you're more or less, in a way, it's has obviously symbolic elements because it's about celebrating the noble savage in a way.
Yes, Les Zan Galant is very interesting and in some ways quite amusing because the idea really is that everybody who lived in these so-called Indies, and we have four sort of separate scenes, the last one is called Les Sauvages, the savages. Well, all the savages have to do if they want to be civilized is to learn how to do the minuet. And that sort of idea of the four scenes, the ballet, the whole thing is, they love this genre, and this is a opera ballet rather than the Lully piece, which is a comedy ballet. Comedy doesn't mean it's funny, it means it's a play because it comes from the word comédien. But the opera ballet was something, and it was the last one ever written. There was a whole string of opera ballets on themes like the Muses or the Seasons, where you could actually have related entrees or ballets on similar themes. There was no more nymphs and cupids and stuff. It tended to be getting away from that kind of thing.
Let's move to the 19th century, the late 19th century, Coppelia in 1870, Le Cid by Massenet in 1885. And had ballet now in Paris become something that we could associate much more closely with ballet today, the idea of companies, theatres, schools, etc.?
I think that it was a situation where we would recognise it as a traditional ballet company. So we might have some problems in recognising the 18th century style of work. But 19th century is really, I think, the foundation of what we see today. So, yes, the hierarchy within the companies, the training in the ballet schools, and everything to do with it was certainly recognisable.
Delibes' journey, Richard, towards the ballet was rather an interesting one.
He wasn't very good at college, basically. His musical training was not outstanding, but he'd had sung in the cathedral scene of Meyerbeer's Le Prophète because he went to the Madeleine Maîtrise, the church school at the Madeleine in Paris, and so he had a very early exposure to the real stage life on the Paris opera stage. And he then teamed up, well, his sort of protege was Adolphe Adam, who is the composer mainly known for Giselle, but who actually really taught him the craft, because he was a composer of 53 operas and 10 mostly forgotten ballets except for Giselle. And he got Delibes a job on the as a repetiteur in a minor opera comique place, really light opera. And then this word we've been coming on, comique, is a very important one, because the ballet comique de la Reine isn't funny. And there was the story of an Englishman who went to the opera comique who didn't speak a word of French but didn't want to let anybody know. And so every now and again he guffawed. And there weren't actually any jokes. It was a very serious opera comique. I mean, Bizet's Carmen is not a bundle of laughs, really. So that word comique has to be stressed, I think.
You must mention Delibes' comic operas that he did write.
The
again,
stories of these things became more and more ridiculous. One was about the cooking of an omelette with all kinds of ashes in it and tobacco and various other things, which were served some guests who wolfed it up and said it was lovely.
At this point, opera wanted in Paris ballet in it, didn't it? It was inconceivable that you could do an opera in Paris without having a dance section to it.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the things that was very sort of characteristic of the French opera, was that you really had to incorporate a dance scene. And a dance scene means, you know, something like 20 minutes of dance. So what we would think of as a one-act ballet, and they were really integral to it. And if you were a composer whose work had gone on elsewhere, so for example, Verdi, he would rewrite his operas for Paris and incorporate the ballet scenes. So it was something that was terribly important. And if you didn't have your opera with a ballet, you would have to add a ballet at the end of the evening.
And no one was exempt. Tannhäuser had a ballet put in.
Well, when it went on, it didn't, and that caused a great deal of problem. So there are rare occasions. But likewise, you didn't go to an evening of ballet, as people expect to do now. You wouldn't just go and see even Coppelia. You would always have another work with it, which would be an opera or a scene from an opera. The idea of a full evening of dance was just horrible.
But the other way around, it meant there was plenty of work for dancers in Paris.
There was an enormous amount of work for dancers in Paris, because not only were they performing at the opera, but there were a lot of popular theatres that incorporated ballet. So within the popular fairy, the sort of fairy tale pantomime productions that were going on, in the music halls there were ballets as well. So actually there were probably more dancers being employed in Paris at that point than there have been sort of before or since.
And was there a crossover between what the dancers were doing, or was there a sort of snobbery that, you know, a certain level was at the opera and then another level was doing the more popular stuff?
I think there is a certain snobbery. So, yes, to be at the Paris Opera was the ultimate. But having said that, there are choreographers who briefly work at the opera and probably were earning good money elsewhere, and why shouldn't they go off and earn good money? Some of the dancers would choose to move from the Paris Opera to the Opera Comique to the music hall. So there was, I think, much more sort of flow. And, of course, there were dancers from abroad who were incorporated into the Paris Opera. They weren't exclusively dancers that they had trained.
We're hearing an authentic instrument performance of all of the works in this concert this evening. So you might, Richard, want to say a bit about how that relates to Coppelia. Horns, I know, are particularly interesting.
Well, the orchestra for Coppelia had completely changed from Rameau. I think three things probably had happened. One was the growth of the wind section and brass section, and the horns in particular, which were not as modern as the horns in the Rite of Spring, where you have valves, and they had to be played either by altering the crooks so that a horn player would come in with several crooks on his arm and change the plumbing, as it were, on the instrument, but also put his fist up the bell, which is how you actually got the two scales enabling you to play chromatic music. And when you do that, you get a very different tone on the stop notes. So that is one thing. There's also the introduction of the instrument, the ophicleide, which is in the Coppelia score and will be heard this evening. And
which is what?
An ophicleide is a large instrument, I think blown like a horn. It's a mouthpiece, not a reed. And also the Other instruments which are very important are the cornet à piston, which is the little trumpets that were still in use at the time up to the 1880s, really, which make a much thinner sound than the modern trumpet. So the wind sound, the sound of the wind section, and this is true for the Rite of Spring as well, is very, very different from how it was going to be today.
Well, let's talk about the Rite of Spring and those famous events of over a century ago. We're promised this evening a recreation of the score as heard at its 1913 premiere, presumably without the shouting and other noises off from the audience, although who knows. This is going to be rather exciting, isn't it?
It's going to be very exciting. I mean, the other thing is, of course, that Stravinsky makes the... We can talk about the instruments, but really it's the people who play them and how you play them, right from Lully all the way through. Because you can now take five or six different performances of music on authentic instruments and they all sound quite different. But the Rite of Spring, certainly, I've never heard it before on these instruments, which have crept forward. You can hear Schumann, you can hear, I think, some Wagner, so-called authentic instruments. And I still think the most important thing is the different sound of the wind. But when you get to Stravinsky, he is making people play higher in the register than they have before. He's making them use harmonics on the violins, playing glissando on harmonics, and all kinds of techniques which really were asking beyond the bounds of what the players could do. Isn't that the same thing with the choreography, in a sense, that Nijinsky asked people to do things sort of out of their comfort zone?
Oh, absolutely. The dancers were absolutely horrified at having to do things that were totally away from their training, indeed inverted their training in many senses. So I think that, yes, it is that sense of really sort of breaking away. I think we must remember that, I mean, we are talking about Paris, and one of the things that's really, I think, fascinating about tonight's concert is the opportunity to hear the music. So we've actually got this sense of evolution. So often we're getting accounts that say, of course, this is a big change from sort of Tchaikovsky and The Sleeping Beauty. Well, for the Parisian audiences, it was still ballets like Coppelia that they were used to. And so it's that is being sort of turned on its head.
Because Tchaikovsky ballets weren't done in Paris?
They weren't being performed in Paris at that point. So it's before we tend to sort of have written history on a universal basis rather than a local basis, so that we don't get a real sense of evolution. It's something that's really rather bizarre. But having said that, I think what was sort of happening with The Rite of Spring was that the ideas for the production certainly came from both the designer Rurik and Stravinsky, and Nijinsky, who choreographed it, comes in very much at the last moment. It's only the year before that he starts to choreograph in terms of main works for the Ballet Russe, and so he is something of a novelty. But he was somebody who was prepared to go completely outside the dancer's comfort zone in everything he did.
Had Paris, by the start of the 20th century, lost a bit of its gloss as world ballet capital? Had some of that gone to St. Petersburg?
Well, I think undoubtedly that there was a real interest in what was happening in St. Petersburg in particular. I think that was... And, it's, you know, reports of dance in the Imperial Ballet were filtering out, so there was an awareness that there was something happening. Having said that, there were still major productions going on in Paris. I think they had become fairly routine, rather less innovative than they had been. So it wasn't a sense that they were moving forward, it was a sense that they were marking time.
So does France have fair claim on the Rite of Spring as being a French ballet, or is it really a Russian ballet?
Oh, it's a Russian ballet, definitely a Russian ballet.
But it just happens
to have been premiered in France. But I think it's also quite interesting that, of course, Parisian audiences do like novelties, and I think that's still true today.
And no shortage, Richard, of Russianness in the music.
The Rite of Spring, I think we're only really now beginning to understand it, in the sense that it is absolutely packed full of Russian wedding songs from various collections, because when it was written, 1909 was the period when we had our equivalent in England, but there was a huge force in many countries to revive folk music, to some extent through the evolution of the phonograph, and to some extent by absolutely avid collectors going around and finding tunes. And the tunes in the Rite of Spring, the melodies that he uses, very simple very often in shape, are actually taken from a book with something like 1,700 Lithuanian wedding songs, which have been found by a recent biographer of Stravinsky, unearthing this whole thing that you were mentioning, Rurik. lyric and the primitive ballet. The idea was somehow that refined art had lost its honesty and purity and that it had to be revived by that.
Yes, I think one must remember that just as Stravinsky is mining the folk tunes and everything, so Rurik was somebody who was absolutely fascinated by Russian history. It's very much the equivalent of, in a way, of our arts and crafts, almost sort of recreating a Russian folk art that was happening at the end of the 19th and early 20th century. And he's building on that. He's also fascinated by archaeology, so there are those elements that go in. So he's drawing on the past. And I think this is one of the things that's very exciting with The Writer's Spring, because here is the work, it's absolutely typical of what modernism is about, that really is based on the past, but is reinterpreted and represented for audiences, for contemporary audiences, and in a way that excites them and, to a certain extent, also shocks them.
It's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you both very much indeed for being with us this evening. Jane Pritchard and Richard Langham Smith.
And that was Petra Trelawney presenting our 20 Minutes feature. Tomorrow's is hosted by Rana Mitter. It's a Proms literary event talking about Mahler's letters.